You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2007 Frankfurt Avenue. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
Let me say that we'll do a sort of this interview that Kristen was talking about. So most of the talking will be done by Nick Esposito, who's next to me. If you... Hopefully you'll be able to see his face to some degree, because it's a very pleasure. He's a pleasurable person to look at, and it's yeah. But I'll you know me. I'll find ways to get some words in there too. But we first met. I feel like it was before the Phillies won the last World Series, but I don't know if that's exactly true. But we were playing baseball in West Philly, and became friends over the years, and. Nick's wife Elisa started this farm 9 years ago. Next year will be the 10th grow season. And they've been excellent neighbors and good practitioners in the community. He's a South Jersey native who has deep roots here in Philadelphia. And some of the work that he's done, he's a writer and an editor. And he started a publishing company called The Head and the Hand Press, which also used to have some space next door to us on Frankfurt Ave there. And there's a bunch of books, and it's the only publisher I know of that has a vending machine where you can get their books. That's that Soup Kitchen Cafe, right? Excellent. He works for the city of Philadelphia, and his particular focus is this rather ambitious project called Zero Waste Philadelphia. So you'll talk some about that. And also, he is the president of the East Kensington Neighbors Association, which is our... This you are in the association zone of ECNA. And he's faithfully done that for his whole term here. And as his term comes to a close, he's not going to seek re-election. As he and Elisa are about to have their second child, and Luca, their son's around here, as well as Honey Pie, their dog, you might catch rolling around. But Nick, I really appreciate you. I've seen him de-escalate some hostile situations. I've seen him bring people together from very different points of view to be able to do something beautiful together. I see you as a hopeful person, and the way that you contribute to the neighborhood, I'm very fond of you. I'm very grateful for you. So thanks again for doing this. So just to get started, talk about this place, Emerald Street Community Farm, how to get going, where are we, what is this about?
Sure. So yeah, thank you all for coming tonight. This is really cool to have everybody here, and sorry it's so dark. It's kind of a cool idea.
It's a cool effect.
A cool day. thanks to Josh for this up. So, Emerald Street was started back in 2008 by my wife Elisa and her friend Patrick Dunn. Some of you might remember Patrick. He lived in the neighborhood for a while and moved out west after a couple of years. So she, when Elisa was like 25, 26, she was kind of, you know, in the midst of a few different things. I've been living in Philly for a while, was living in South Philly, and really wanted to kind of like dig into community a little bit more. Wanted to buy a house, but she also really wanted to do a project around growing food, doing something positive with a space in the city, and also just around like public health, things of that nature. So she got together with Patrick, and they were able to kind of create this space. So where we're sitting was at one time, you know, the fence was up, and it was a, you know, used to be houses here, and it was just a vacant lot. There was actually a VW bus parked right where these tomato trellises are. There was trash all around it, weeds. So Elisa came and started cleaning it out, and actually in the front, in the corner, you'll see there's some beds there. She kind of, you know, they found them as they were coming, and then neighbors came over afterwards, and we're like, oh yeah, we actually used to garden here way back in the day, and kind of stopped doing it. It's, you know, cool that you're doing it again. We're pretty supportive of it. You know, wasn't as you should to make sure. Yeah, they were a little suspicious, like, who's this person who just moved in who's doing all this work? But if you've met Elisa, you know, like, her way about her, and she was able to build community with them. So When her and Patrick first started this place, it was, you know, they were definitely trying to figure out like their, like how they were gonna, they always knew they wanted it to be community space, they wanted it to be educational, but they didn't know exactly what that looked like. So they had like kind of a community garden where people had single plots in the back, and then this was kind of a communal growing area. When I moved over in 2011, Elisa and I really sat down and started thinking like, what do we want this space to be? I had my own experiences organizing community farms out in West Philly. And we really focused on, I heard a really great quote one time in this documentary about Detroit urban farming. And this guy said, you know, I would take 15 people over $15,000 any day of the week. And that's really what we believed in. It's like, how can we get people in this space to contribute in this collective kind of communal way? So we decided to make the entire thing communal. You know, we kept the pavilion back there for educational opportunities. And we run it every Monday, starting at 5 right after work for most people. We kind of keep gardening until sundown, and it's anybody can come and work as much as they want or as little as they want. They can take as much food or as little food as they want. And over the years of doing that, it's been a growing process. In many ways, I use gardening puns constantly. I don't even notice I do it anymore. But so, you know, it is a hard, you know, we'll talk a lot, probably a lot more about this, but that value proposition that people think like, well, is this really like, oh, I feel self-conscious, I didn't work enough, or should I really take this? And we've gotten people to be able to really understand that, no, this is exactly like what the space is supposed to be. It's inclusive, and it's really meant to do that. Josh, you'd asked before about like why I love this space so much, and other pieces that I don't, you know, so many aspects we have to do social media, whether it's like personal or professional. And it's really nice that this has just been around so long. And that's kind of the whole thing of gardening. You plant plants in the ground for so long and they grow and mature. The space just becomes its own ecosystem and people just know it's here and they utilize it. And it's just this community grassroots space. The last thing I say, I didn't say this in the last session, but if you were quiet, we'll be quiet for a second. The car's right by, but what do you hear when you're sitting there?
Crickets,
yeah. It's like pretty incredible, and all this sky, and it's like really wild that my son gets to grow up in a place where he can like, you know, walk to the rec center, be around all these like kids and people, but be able to like climb through the fence and run into the berry patch and hear crickets at night and see stars and have, you know, birds. And not only is it so great that he gets to do that, but we also get to invite so many other kids that get to come over and enjoy that and have that outlet as well. So hopefully, you know, a lot of parents are here. You guys utilize this. And that's really what I think the most special piece of it is, that it's not just we took over this big plot of land and we have our little, you know, kingdom over here. It's that this is a community space that everyone gets to share. And we contribute a lot, but it's great that everybody gets to use it.
I like that. We experiment with a lot of those same things, especially the alternative economic relationships. So even you're talking about like, you know, sweat equity or not necessarily even sweat equity, but a sweat economy, a gift economy. For a lot of people, those things are so far beyond their norm, it's tricky to get into it. A lot of folks here helped work on this mural, I think, but a lot of us know nothing about it. So just, you can see it now, the paint on the wall, Jesse and Julia's house. And that kind of came about because Dmitry Kadiev was coming to town. A lot of us are friends with him. And I wanted to find him somewhere to paint. He likes to do work for justice movement places across the country and then in a few different countries. And I spoke to Nick kind of in passing a couple months ago about like, hey, my boy's coming through. You know, maybe we can do a mural. And then texted him, I think, and was like, hey, remember that mural I talked about? It can happen in 2 days if you want to get started. But what was that like for you, and what meaning does it represent now?
Yeah, so, you know, one, it represented just this like incredible gift of community and friendship, and that you were able to have that. You know, we had been talking about doing a mural on that wall for like a long time. Now we've had artists come look at it, at varying prices of how much it would cost. And, you know, a lot of it was cost prohibitive for, we have so many other things that we need to do. We don't really use a lot of money on this space to keep it going. So we never had the means to do it. And then, Josh, and thank you all, and we all contribute to Circle of Hope to be able to come and say, you know, we have resources that can come and get this mural going. But then really, the gift of Dmitry, I mean, a lot of you know him, you know the kind of person he is, and it was just it was incredible meeting him and thinking back. I don't know. He reminded me of a lot of people that I've met along. I've traveled a lot in my life and have been around different places, and he reminded me of some of like the best people that I've met. And I think that his personality of being this very just open, gracious, you know, kind of roll with it kind of person, who's also extremely joyful and happy, was like the personification of this place. You know, like, we don't have a lot of money to keep the space going. It's a lot of swag equity. There's a lot of faith. There's a lot of joy that keeps it going. And he was like that embodied in a person who painted on a wall. So the mural, I think itself, is exact representation too of what we wanted. You know, this whole, we have ideals and we have values that we try to put forth, but we never too much about a message or anything. We didn't really want that on the wall. We just wanted something that was really beautiful, something that people could connect with, that would kind of bring some vibrancy to the community, especially if people walk to the L, which they do a lot. That's what this garden brings. That's why we plant flowers. We just don't grow vegetables. We have flowers all over. And we try to really keep that going. So it was the perfect fit. And it was a lot of fun.
It's good to paint with you. And Luca was out there a lot, throwing some paint on the walls. It's so adorable and helpful. So a lot of us probably noticed Emerald Park across the street, maybe for the first time. Did you, or maybe you didn't, but there's a big green space over there. You have a beautiful yard, and you have a farm right here, and you're talking about the crickets and stuff. How important do you think green space is in the neighborhoods and land, right? Because even what you're talking about is bringing it back to the land. In a changing neighborhood, land becomes so precious that preserving green spaces is really difficult if you don't have leaders in the neighborhood, particularly, who even have access to other leaders to do it. And as I ask you that question, I would just so you know, he's been helping out a lot of the green spaces in our neighborhood, including the Frankfurt Ave Garden, as we sort out that whole business. But so what does land mean to you in that sense of the green space, of locality, of both close to where you live and then even for our whole neighborhood?
Yeah, you know, and I said this in the last session or whatever. So, you know, the idea of like land to me is this idea of like what we live in. You know, Pennsylvania is called a commonwealth. And just thinking about that word and really unpacking it, because it's easy to think, even like a state, right? We live in a state, we live in a commonwealth. What does that mean? Like, and the words are pretty self-explanatory. It's like, it's a commonwealth. It's, there's a lot of wealth that you can get from the land, but it should be put and used towards a common good. And there's a lot of land that we have right now in Philadelphia that is vacant, that was once, you know, and as people think, like, occupied or in use. Well, like, land is always in use. Something or someone is always using it to varying degrees. And I think one is recognizing that and knowing where that value is and the kind of what is value. I've talked about the value proposition before. And, you know, I think in this city and even this country and definitely the world, you know, I mean, we have a very kind of tenuous relationship with land sometimes, like the idea of land ownership or the idea of, you know, whose land was or what's going on in land, you know, on land. And I think being able to kind of communicate that message across different needs, but then at the same time, understanding that at the end of the day, it should all really go back to kind of contributing to the common good, whether it's housing for somebody, you know, so they can have a family in a house and, you know, kind of call somewhere to call their home and feel belonging to. But then at the same time, like our ecosystem, that how important that is, that we live in an ecosystem. And I think Philadelphia is one of the most unique examples of that for amongst cities. Some people don't think of Philadelphia is so beautiful in some parts, but we have some incredible, beautiful places. Wissahickon, you get real deep in there, and it's like, it's crazy that we have that in the city. You don't hear cars anymore. You're in the middle of the woods, you know. I was on a trail in North Carolina. It looked just like Wissahickon. How do we protect those spaces? How do we come together on them? And how do we understand how they fit into this, you know, fabric of our community? And that's really what we try to show here at Emerald Street. And we try to support that wherever we can. It's a privilege to be able to support that in other instances like Frankfurt Echo.
Well, yeah, man, you've gone to bat for us, and I appreciate it. Speaking of the beautiful Philadelphia, I think one of the ways that you're considering, and a lot of the different agencies that you're working with in the city, is how to even conceptualize a reality that really doesn't exist yet with zero waste. For most people, we are maybe even feel inundated by trash, or we feel disconnected from where our waste, what happens to our waste, whether it's, you know, I think we're very disconnected to what happens in the toilet after it leaves the toilet, but even like the trash trucks or recycling trucks. So would you talk a little bit about your, this vision for zero waste, and what are some of the things about it that excite you, that make you want to do it?
So, well, what it's interesting is you brought that up, and we didn't bring that up in the last time we talked, but like sanitation is a gift. Like, it's incredible that we have this thing where you can gather all of your trash, you put it into a curb, somebody comes and picks it up and takes it away. Like, that is, that's not just something that just like should be and just happens. There's a whole incredible intricate system of so many people that have to make that happen every day. We have 540,000 households we pick up from the streets department, and I don't think people fully recognize how the impact of that is and what it would be like if we didn't do that. So that's the first thing that's connecting back. So the zero waste that we're doing, so it's part of this cabinet that was put together by the Kennedy administration back in December that I was asked to lead through the administration. We just put out an action plan in August. And what's great about the plan is two things. One is the main part in our mission. A word I always focus on is interdepartmental. People say like, oh, why is this going to be, why is this going to clean up Philly? Why is this going to really make change? And it's really that aspect. You know, a lot of times city departments will kind of operate in silos and they don't always communicate. And having all of these different entities at the table with this shared mission. And having, and again, I joke that like, my job is such a pleasure because there's no, even though it's really hard and overwhelming, there's no like pro trash lobby. There's no people that we need more trash in Philadelphia. What's wrong with you? You know, even the people like landfill people are excited we're doing this because we're running out of space, and this is actually going to, they don't have to go find another, like, because they're not going to find more land around here to build a landfill. It's impossible. So that could actually keep their operations going for a little bit longer. So it's kind of, it makes things a little bit easier, even though it is a big challenge. The second part is that this is an action plan. This isn't just, and please look it up. It's on cleanphl.org. That's our main kind of cabinet website. This isn't just some like recommendations and far off theoretical thing that we're going to try to do. I mean, we have real action steps we're going to take to zero waste. So what zero waste is basically a future. It's a design principle. It's been around for about two decades where you will divert 90% of material from a landfill. So when I say divert, it means instead of going to the landfill, you're going to recycling, composting, reuse. I didn't call this out in the last thing, but I have to give a shout out to Circle Thrift for the great work that you all do. I mean, that's a zero waste practice, right? When people take this thing back with their, you know, materials that could go into our landfill, and then are able to actually put it back at an extremely, extremely reasonable cost back into the community is incredible. We're actually going to be taking that into our zero waste diversion rate, like donations and things like that in the future. Well, a couple other things about our definition, if you look in the plan, that I think are really unique for our city, is that we also say we don't just want to divert waste. We want to actually take the full amount of waste, whether it's going to, it's not being wasted, recycling or compost, but actually have that number reduced. Because we are at a place right now in this disposable culture that we created that is just completely unsustainable. Even though we've gotten a lot better with sustainability, it's a word that's, you know, gotten so much buzz since even the 70s and 80s. We throw out three times the amount of trash now than we did in 1960. Even though, so that's 300% more with a 30% population increase. That means we are throwing out substantially more trash. And making an impact on our planet, so, and consuming more. So these are things that we need to think about. So we're going to say by those numbers in 2015, by 2035, when our goal is set, we want to actually reduce waste. Another big piece of it is, you know, they'll say, well, you're saying 90% diversion, but I thought it was zero. What's zero? Well, we have to always include 10% of the materials that you're just not going to be able to do. I call it the conundrum of the chip bag, right? Like, what do you do with a chip bag? You can't, until it's made to be composted, there's certain things we're just going to have to throw away for the time being. So we'll send that to waste to energy, which actually most of your municipal waste, pretty much nothing goes to a landfill. It's all mostly either being recycled or goes to waste to energy. There's a plant down in Chester. It basically burns trash and turns it into electricity. We cap that at 10% in the future because we don't want to use that as a crutch. And we don't just want to say, oh, we're just, everything's going to waste energy. Just keep consuming, you know, no big deal. And we also, there's environmental concerns, obviously. We want to get away from burning things to create energy. So, that I think is a very unique and progressive. Not many cities, I think we're the only city that has that type of definition for how we're going to approach things. So that's the goal in the future. By 2035, that's where we hope to be, and we have some really exciting, I'm sure we'll talk more about some of the things that we're doing to do.
Yeah, so what are some of the little habits that you hope will change? Because I know, like, litter, Nick has a visceral reaction to littering, and I honor that about him. A couple weeks ago, we were walking down Kensington Ave for the March in Black. A lot of you were there, bringing attention, solidarity, awareness, and grief to people struggling through the heroin and the opioid epidemic right now. But even just, I saw him just going over to the side, picking up little pieces of trash in Kensington Ave, and I was like, man, that is the kind of, that kind of dream is so compelling to me of, you're going to do the little things, knowing that it works together for the bigger thing. But I know, for me, one of the big exciting things is banning the plastic bag in Philadelphia. And that to me, it just, like, excites me. But what are some of the other little things that we could either start doing now, or what can we expect that are just sort of like changes to the average person's habits?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, that's, so it's a thing, you know, and I brought this up in the last time we talked, is, you know, a big guiding principle of the cabinet and of the whole plan, and this comes from the managing director, Mikey Gardinas, who I work for, who's an old-time activist in Kensington. For those of you who don't know him, he's been in the neighborhood for a really long time. He was part of KJAC back in the 70s. They taken over houses and, like, guerrilla, like, setting up, you know, water and heat for people, and then ended up all these houses, and really people ended up in home ownership because of it. So he has this idea of, like, the social compact, and it's an old idea, you know, it's like pretty much how democracy was founded. So it's, you know, what is government going to do for you, and how are you going to, or what is it going to create the infrastructure, the opportunity, the resources that you're then able to utilize as a resident to then be successful with and kind of be a part of? But they're two interdependent things, right? Like, you have to have, you know, a government that's willing to do that and wanting to really serve the people, and then the people really understanding the value of it and being able to, you know, share it and respect it as well. So that's something we need to get to. So some of the things that we're working towards are, you know, better access to more recycling that you're able to do, not just curbside, even though we're trying to improve curbside, trying to things like e-waste and appliances and things like that. We'd be sanitation centers all over the city that we're trying to get more access to and try to figure out creative ways that we're trying to go forward. We're community compost, or citywide composting is, like, on the table right now and actively being discussed on figuring out how we can bring curbside composting to the city. And again, I'm actually thankful I can, like, practice what I preach. We have a community compost collective that runs right back there from Jen Messler to does Philly Compost. But then we're also going to be doing things like much more education. We have a program that's going to launch next month called Philicycle. It's going to be the new recycle bank. Any recycling rewards people here? Mm-hmm. Use recycling rewards?
Yes.
So we're going to be changing that platform. You're going to be getting more rewards for more zero waste practices, more ways to actually really get involved on the ground. We're going to be doing building audits in municipal and commercial buildings to get buildings to really think about, like, what is the waste we generate and where does it go? I mean, that's the biggest thing, right? We have to get people to be like, where does my waste actually go? And then as a city government, we have to say, well, here's better options than, you know, what's happening now. And that's kind of the bigger picture, but it really is on the ground, because it takes, we could set up all the compost, everything. Curbside recycling is a great example. It's great. We went from a 5% recycling rate in the city back in 2007, with some neighborhoods not reporting any recycling, and you had to, like, separate all your recycling from glass, plastic, paper. Now we're at a 22%, and that's actually above most of cities in the United States. This neighborhood's at 26%. So good job if you live in the neighborhood. So, yeah, we need to be able to get people to actually want to be able to do these things.
There's a theme in what you're saying that I hope that you'll carry into two different sort of topics, but rather than having just a systemic critique or demand for an institution, would be it the federal government or a political party or the church or your neighborhood advisory council, rather than just having critique or demand, I hear from you personal responsibility, a personal contribution being something that you are more focused on. And I appreciate that. speaking in the sort of philosophical, spiritual sense, could you describe that shift that you had? Because for some folks, Nick is not, we'll just say, no, Nick is non-religious. And I think that it's, there can be misconceptions about even the shifts that happen because in religious, or if, because when you're non-religious, you went from non-religious to non-religious, you know, in some ways, right? I mean, yeah. That's a, but within that broader framework or broad brush, I think there was a significant change. Mm-hmm. And would you talk about that shift?
Sure, yeah. So, I've been pretty open about this. I talk about, like, with my life and stuff. So, like, I was raised, like, you know, by two really great parents, like, you know, Roman Catholics. So I was kind of brought up in Catholic tradition. And, you know, I feel like with Italians and Catholicism, it's more about, like, food and holidays than, like, actually going to church. But I had that basis. But, you know, getting the lessons from them, especially my father. My father is a recovering addict, and he had, you know, 32 years of active addiction, which is mostly through my childhood and into my adult years. And he, you know, raised us as atheists, basically. I mean, it was just kind of, you know, there was not, we didn't really, you know, think about, you know, God, the concept. He had a lot of, you know, he wasn't the kind of guy who, like, shared his opinions all the time. It was just kind of like what we picked up from him. I picked up a lot from him. You know, big care on, like, science and things like that. But when he was in his active addiction, he'll even admit this, there was a certain tinge of, like, nihilism that was wrapped in that. And when he got clean, it was really interesting because he went into NA, and if you all know NA, there's, you know, one of the steps is, the first one is, you know, accepting that there's a higher, or accepting that you have a problem, and there's a higher power other than yourself. And in NA, they call it the God of your understanding. So they try to make it inclusive, but they still say there's something bigger than you out there. And I had kind of formed my own thoughts and my own reading about, like, my own kind of, like, atheism, basically. But watching him kind of go through this transition of kind of shedding off his nihilism really made me, you know, I wasn't an addict, I didn't have that side of it, but it did definitely make me take stock of, like, well, what do I believe in? Like, what is my value system? And, you know, I was very fortunate at the time because I watched him go through this, and I was also very, very steeped in national service. I did national service to the National Civilian Community Corps. I was a Katrina reliever, and, like, at that time, volunteering, being in service, being in public service was what really kind of, like, filled that hole, I guess, that really was there that I didn't even really acknowledge. And it's, like, that belief in humanity, that belief in, you know, society and my fellow human, you know, and I think that in community. And, you know, I see that value set kind of line up very closely with, you know, what is going on here. And I think, you know, that's the hard part about people who subscribe to that, is just thinking of this kind of critique on religion, seeing, you know, I was talking about this before, this, like, kind of Marxist, like, socialist view of the world where, you know, when you're reading that, it's talking about these, like, big, major, oppressive, like, structures, whether it's, like, the, you know, papacy and the Roman Catholic Church, or, you know, big nations and corporations and things. And when you get down to this level that we're on right now, like, we're just people trying to do the best thing for our community. Mm-hmm. And getting into that whole larger picture creates these divisions that really does not help any of us and really doesn't push anything forward. And I think that being able to see, you know, at the end of the day, if we all sat down and talked, we have the same exact, like, we have very similar value sets. I think recognizing that and acknowledging that, using it to advantage, is really what I think is going to bring people together in a positive way that's really going to help progress our society.
Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good. How are you all doing? Is your back getting sore a little bit? Okay. Let's be mindful of the backs. And if you want to have any kind of final remarks or something, sure, hold them in your mind. But first, let's see if it, does anybody else have a question that they want to ask? We have a couple minutes for talk back or question response. Fact check.
Is it a myth, or is it true that we import for money a lot of trash and recycling from other states?
In the Philadelphia or Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania.
I don't. I have to, like, get back to, like, the full answer. My instinct is to say no, that we do not take in trash from other states. I think, in the state of Pennsylvania, I do know that some trash has been coming from Northeast Pennsylvania. They have landfills in, like, the Scranton area. There's, like, a couple people who have some very big landfills. I think they do take waste from New York. But in this southeast of Pennsylvania, We don't. But I did say in the last talk the number one export that the United States has is waste. That's our number one waste.
Yeah. Say something about that.
Yeah.
Expound that.
So
which documentary should we watch?
Oh yeah.
We have a lot of documentary watchers, so yeah. You're speaking their love language.
Oh, so great. I just watched this. I didn't say great because it's kind of harrowing to watch, but there's a great documentary called Plastic China, and it's about it starts off with just a few of the quick facts, but then it just basically tracks the life of this family trying to make it in, I forget the exact city in China, but it's a smaller city. And in the city though, there's 5,000 plastic recyclers. So like periodically there are these big trucks that come in and dump all this plastic, and then they take it, and they're basically these, like, it would be like in our backyard, this big vat, where they're basically cooking down the plastic, turning it into a slurry, processing it into these little pellets. And the whole time you're watching it, there's like kids playing in all the plastic. They're burning plastic for fuel because they don't have any fuel. They're inhaling all of this. And then if like stuff just doesn't get processed, they just burn it. There's a lot of plastic. I mean, I think there is a myth. I think we call it wish cycling in the industry, where you think like, oh, this is recycling or recyclable, or it's definitely going to get recycled. And a lot of it just doesn't get recycled. It ends up in landfills, ends up in the trash. There's e-waste that's in pits in Africa. There's plastic that's just being trashed in China. And China actually is getting really sick of this. I actually saw the documentary, some of the party leadership there, the Communist Party, and they are putting down a very, very stark kind of, they did a thing called the Green Fence in 2013, where they got much more judicious about what comes in. Now they have a new program called National Sword that is going to very much limit what can come into the country. So that could actually really affect the curbside recycling in the United States over the next couple of years. So as a city, we're trying to get ready for that, to see what that impact's going to be. But it's definitely coming in. But when I sit with my colleagues, I'm like, this is a positive. This is what we've been wanting to do. This is a wake-up call that people just can't keep throwing things away and expecting it just to go somewhere and feel good about, you know, the system. It's not that easy, and we need to take more stock of it and responsibility.
Allison.
Why aren't there any more wire trash cans on the street corners?
So as part of the cabinet, we did a behavioral study on that. So we are actually trying to, again, it's not just putting a trash can on a corner. There's this whole like ripple effect that happens with that, whether it's like the people that come and pick it up, how it gets serviced. There's a lot of communities, sometimes they'll request a trash can, and then 2 months later we'll get the call back and they're like, take this trash can away because people are dumping on it. It's become more of a problem than it was. So there's so many considerations to take, and we actually just did a study with a couple of universities to say, you know, what are the effects when you add trash cans? What's the best method for it? What's the right amount in the neighborhood? Where should they be placed? So we're trying to be methodical. You know, I take that to heart. I know a lot of my colleagues in the Kennedy administration do. Like, we get up, we go to work for 1.5 million people every day, and we spend their tax money. And if you do it unwisely and you don't think of what you're doing, you can cause a lot of big problems and actually make your mission harder on you. So we're trying to be a little smarter on how we do that. Hopefully, it's my opinion, we should have more, but we have to make sure it's the right thing.
You like the ones with the solar compactors?
The big bellies? Yeah, Big Belly's been a game changer. They don't sometimes seem that way. We actually had a little problem because we had a contract with the company that basically there's a transponder that like sends a ping back to downtown that says that the can is full, and then we send people out to go pick them up. That system broke down for a little bit. We actually just got it back online. That's why the Big Belly's have looked not so great in the last couple months. It's back online. We're getting back to it. But yeah, it went like some places we would go for like, it turned, you know, in a month where we do like 17 pickups, it turned it into 2 pickups because it compacts and it lets us know. We're not just guessing, oh, we should drive by and see if we need to empty it. We actually have better data to do it, so.
So this problem can seem kind of trash and engaging with like how much we are consuming. And I think for a lot of us, we're very, very large. And a lot of us are already probably practicing like different ways to reduce our consumption, but idea of like, no step is too small kind of thing. What actions would you suggest for like day-to-day practices, or how like can we be helping you and your job and mission?
Yeah, and there's the things I said before, like, you know, about like, you know, if you can compost, you can figure out a way to do it. You can figure out ways like substitutes for plastics, things of that nature. A big thing that people could really help out with, and I didn't say this in the last one, so it'd be great if like Circle could spread it, and we say this all the time, is we call it proper set outs of trash. Like, and I'm sure like a lot of you already kind of do that, but as much as it's, I know these are hard conversations to have with neighbors, and we're trying to make better spaces for that to do that. But you know, a lot of people say like the dirtiest day in the neighborhood is trash day, because the sanitation workers come through and they don't care, they just throw everything around. And I always remind people, I'm like, first off, I've been on the back of trash trucks before. The day I went out, it was 28 degrees and it was tough that day. You know, I'm in a jumpsuit, I've got gloves, my hands were numb half an hour into it. I'm still pitching, you know, try 4 more hours to do on my route. When it's 98 degrees, it's the same thing. So imagine you're in those conditions. You've come across a neighbor who put out like their entire furniture set, and then the next neighbor has a bunch of little Wawa bags that are tied up. You have to pick one out individually and throw them in, and the next neighbor is just completely overflowing. It's like their job is so hard. So as much as people can do in the neighborhoods to just make sure that that recycling bin is nice and neat, your trash is tied up, it's in a thing, that really is a huge, it's everybody just put out a reasonable amount of trash every week that was nice and neat and tidy, this city would be a completely different place. So as much as we can all work together on that mission, that's huge.
What was the name of the practice again?
Proper set outs.
Proper set outs. I love tactical terms, Nick. I'm sorry.
You know, our terms are very British too. Like proper set outs. We call it like rubbish, like downtown, like all of our things. Like when we have all our spreadsheets, it's like rubbish recycling.
I like rubbish too. Is there maybe one or two more? Amanda.
We don't as much. We haven't. I used to run a program. So before I went to this job I'm in now, I worked for Parks and Recreation for years. So I've been a public servant for a long time. And my first job in the city, I kind of got off the ground this program called PowerCorp EHL, which is an AmeriCorps program. They call it like at-risk 18 to 26-year-old. And we actually had them, and I was doing training. It was like an upstart. And it was just like, we had to get these guys like some kind of training. So I actually came here and helped build out like the kitchen area and stuff. So we've had that, but not much. It's a pretty, like, we have like a very solid crew of people that come every Monday and pretty much get everything done. So not much of a need, but we never turn to people want to come, and we give tours and we do stuff like that. So if you have an idea, please let me know afterwards. And we're always looking.
I just did
there
for myself.
Congratulations. Thanks for serving.
Hey, Nick, can you talk about what it's been like to have the neighbors that you started building relationships leaving?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Julius, because that's a big thing. So when we first started the garden, that's another thing, too, because like the whole thing of like some concepts of gentrification came up in the last talk that we did. And I feel like the mistake people make with gentrification is they, and I kind of alluded to this a little bit, that it's this kind of like, very, very nice and neat up and down kind of thing, you know, and that, like, you know, there's like these neighborhoods that were, you know, had all this manufacturing, and then it like declined, and there was a decline, and now it's coming back up, and there's all these problems, and it's not as cut and dry and neat like that. So when Elisa first moved in back in 2008, that apartment complex across the street was just full of, you know, like a bunch of like old Dominican men used to sit out and play dominoes and like hang out. It was like very quiet, you know, it wasn't a big deal. And then when the Somerset stop got shut down with them, and they kind of, SEPTA went there and they kind of really started like having a thing. It's kind of similar to what's happening now with Gurney Street and the camp being shut down. A lot of it spread into the neighborhoods. And at that time, there wasn't as much activity. I mean, a lot of people lived in the neighborhood when all that happened. And then all of a sudden, I had first moved in. It's funny, that was the first time I watched The Wire when I moved in. So I'm like, I'm watching that. All this is happening. And there's like shootings every week. We had a drive-by shooting at Halloween one year. While we had our big Halloween celebration. Their dealers are doing like free tastings in the park across the street. It was crazy, like what was happening. And, you know, that's one of those things. You didn't see that. Like, you know, we definitely, looked like it was a neighborhood in decline, but then it just got really, really bad. But at the same time, in that apartment complex, and that's where some drug dealers have moved in, there were a lot of kids that lived there, and those kids were like the main people that came over to the garden and were utilizing it. We still have kids come back, and they've moved like north of Lehigh near like the Fairhill section. And one like young kid we were really close to comes back still to like help us out. He comes to our movie nights, and it's like it was hard to like have those families leave. And I think that's like the impression that you know, obviously we can all agree it's nice that you're not hearing gunshots anymore and there's redevelopment and the neighborhood's getting nicer, but, you know, there are those families that, you know, people do get displaced, and it's true, and it's something that I think we always have to keep in mind. We want to have, you know, development and progression, but we want to make sure that it's for everyone. And that's definitely a change in demographic. We have kids now, but it's, you know, a lot of the kids that are being born now in this neighborhood, newer people that have moved in. So it still fits the mission, and we're still proud to serve and happy, but it is something we think about at this moment.
Well, I will just say thank you one more time on a microphone for letting us meet here tonight.
Of course.
We were in a gnarly situation, yeah. But your hospitality is moving, and especially your just readiness. And I think I actually were like, you better ask Elise.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't say yes so fast. Yeah. It's like, wow, it's so cool.
Oh, no, and I said this in the last thing, you know, Bethany's here tonight. Like, I, you know, again, this isn't like, there's nothing like transactional about it. It was like, well, you did this for me, so I'll do this for you. But it's like, that's the thing. It's like, even though, like, yeah, this is a non-denominational, it's not a religious space, you know, it's a community space. But I look at what the work you all do is it's community work, right? And it's like every week or every second Wednesday of the month, our zoning meetings are at Circle. We had a fringe show that was here a couple weekends ago, and it was like threatening with the rain. So Elisa emails me and is like, can you Circle figure this out? So on Tuesday, I email Bethany, and she's like, sure, yeah, you can just be there on Saturday. Like, you know, we'll figure it out. And it's just like that kind of, you know, for me to be able to kind of, you know, pay that back and be able to kind of be there for you guys when you needed it, it was the only thing I could do. So I was very, very happy to be able to do that.
Well, I appreciate you, man. You inspire me. Thank you for the partnership and all the love and the effort you put in. Could we thank him together with some applause?
Thank you.
Then Bethany is going to give us some news and Julius will lead us a prayer.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.